One of the things I'm really excited for is to see some of these things play out, where Flyshock combined with some of the leveraging derivatives in Bitcoin, the buying pressure is pretty. What I think young people have found really worthwhile is that Bitcoin is the thing that is going to store value better than real estate. But imagine if the supply shock that you mentioned is the lead up to Bitcoin's price action, for which now the short is getting squeezed. You actually have to cover it. And when that happens, I think that's actually the biggest fireworks for Bitcoin price action. And once that Rubicon is crossed,
what's up, guys? Before we get started, I've realized that over 50,000 of you guys keep coming back for every single episode. And while I'm internally grateful for you guys to keep coming back, I've realized that 79% of you guys are not subscribed. So I have one small ask before we get started. If you guys could hit that subscribe button and hit that like button to help send this interview and many more to the stratosphere, it would be greatly appreciated. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Jeff Park of Bitwise in the house. But Jeff, we've had some recent positive price action here, and it seems like everybody is now starting to wake up to the fact about Bitcoin. But you work at Bitwise and you guys have one of the larger ETFs in the game. And there's always the narrative that, you know, retail isn't really here yet, and that, you know, people are still buying the ETFs, and that's traditional financial, you know, people, right? The financial advisors, now that they have these ETF products. I'm curious, one, where do you think we're going in this cycle? Do you think we've just even scratched the surface? And two, do you think traditional finance has even gotten into the game just yet?
Man, I think we're still early, and we still talk to a variety of RIAs and financial advisors who are still trying to understand and wrap their head around Bitcoin. And I think one thing that's been really helpful is that this year, despite the incredible price action with the stock market and select companies in the tech sector in particular, the actual kind of outperformer that caught a lot of traditional investors off guard is gold. Gold is actually leading the way. And I think that opens the purview to then have conversations about global macro. And there's a wedge in which Bitcoin can enter the conversation in a thoughtful way, piggybacking off of gold's phenomenal success this year. So I think that's been pretty additive. And then secondly, everything that has been unfolding with a lot of chaos and volatility, including the trade war and the tariffs imposed, is coming to a point where I think it's been digested and people are able to see the impact it's had on inflation. And all of the measures today, as we've seen it so far, would intimate that we are going to continue to have a pretty smooth landing. And we are, in fact, going to get rate cuts later this year. And I think all of that affirmation is bringing a lot of risk on sentiment back to the market as well, which is, of course, always additive to Bitcoin. Then, of course, you had on the back where we've had one of the largest fiscal stimuluses, again, in the backdrop of government spending and the tax cut bill. And all of these things continue to pound the table as to the importance of having a diversified exposure into something like Bitcoin. So I think 2025 is really the year that institutional investors have woken up to the reality that fiscal dominance is real. That's why gold is up. And now they're considering, hey, can Bitcoin also be a correlated asset in that theme, but uncorrelated in its price action?
Yeah, that's interesting. You touched on a lot there, and I kind of want to dive into the more of the macro situation, because, you know, you brought up potential rate cuts, right? So Powell, you know, there's been rumors circulating he's going to step down and all of these things. Trump is calling for a 300 basis point cut, and there's a lot of, you know, chatter around that. And everybody thinks that, hey, once rate cuts happen, Bitcoin's going to absolutely explode. And then on top of it, we've got the big, beautiful bill where they're going to, you know, increase a lot of spending here. So I feel even without rate cuts that, you know, once government spending increases, that Bitcoin's price is going to increase as well, because the way that traditional finance is looking at it is still kind of almost as an inflation hedge. Now, I'm curious kind of your thoughts on both of those aspects. With or without rate cuts, how do you think Bitcoin is going to potentially react here?
Yeah, great question. I think the biggest drivers is really tangential to the liquidity injection that is possible within fiscal stimulus, which is really the question. Number one is the Fed's balance sheet. What is the Fed's balance sheet going to be doing for the remainder of the year? And the second question is, what's dollar strength and where is that trajectory looking like? And those two things have touch points to what you just mentioned on fiscal stimulus. But I think those are the key focus points for most investors. A remarkable stat I'll share with you is that the Fed's balance sheet as a percentage of GDP back in, let's say, 2007, before the financial crisis, was something like 5 to 6% of GDP. And I think it was maybe like 800 billion or something like that. Fast forward today in 2025, the Fed balance sheet as a percentage of GDP is north of 20%. It's something closer to 25%. And it's in the trillions, right? Now we're talking, it's in the $6 to $7 trillion of balance sheet acquisition growth. So that I think is actually a pretty domineering theme as to how people are trying to understand where is the direction of the market in terms of what is the Fed's balance sheet going to look like next year in the way that they're trying to find ways to dispose some of the assets and its liabilities. So that's the open question, and that has a lot of impact to market liquidity, global liquidity, dollar source and funding, and all the things that really come to intersection for Bitcoin investors. But here, I think the general good news is that the Fed's been generally pretty accommodative, I think, to understanding that trajectory in a pretty thoughtful way, which is, I think, the biggest pushback that you hear often about the rate cut delay versus Trump wanting it urgently is rooted on this notion that the tariff price escalation is really like a one-time endeavor, right? Like if tariffs happen and it raises consumer price, let's say it raises it by 10%, that's a one-time event. It doesn't have 10% increasing every year thereafter, right? Tariffs is a one-time hit. And actually the Fed generally should be guiding policies towards the rate of change and not solving for one-time hits. So I think the sympathetic side of why people would say the Fed needs to start cutting rates is to be accommodative of the fact that inflation has come in. And if it actually goes up one time, it doesn't mean the rate of inflation itself is changing. It's just a one-time hit. And I think people are coming around to that because people are seeing that inflation is slowing post the hits that have occurred. And it's not going to be a thing we live with, right? It's just a one-time adjustment. So it is important, I think, at some level that we do get some accommodation on that front. But really, the most important thing is the long-term rate. And people will be focused on the long end of the curve, which is actually where most of the business financing opportunities and economic growth is happening. To that point, this goes back to the Fed balance sheet. There is an asset liability mismatch right now on the Fed's balance sheet, right? The Fed is literally losing money every year because the assets they've purchased are at a loss. They're underwater because they engaged in a kind of maturity transformation where they're long a variety of long duration assets. And of course, most of the liabilities they have are short term in nature, right? It's currencies outstanding. It's the Treasury General Account and it's the bank reserves. And those are all generally short-term liabilities. So that's the open question. How is the Fed going to affect the disposition of its assets in a way that promotes the chance for long end of the tail of the yield curve to come in? And when that happens, I think that's actually the biggest fireworks for Bitcoin price action.
So then what do you think that the fireworks of the Bitcoin price action entails? Is it, starting to get these corporations FOMO into it? Is it a multitude of factors? Like, where do you think the fireworks are going to, I guess, kind of come from? I guess the big bag holders, so to speak.
I think that it'll be normalized for every institutional investor to own Bitcoin. And that means we'll have incrementally new buyers. Bitcoin, like a commodity, always moves based on marginal supply and marginal demand. It's really that simple. And I know you know it, Brandon, because you followed it. And that's why we see these asymptotic cliffs to the ups and to the downs. And because there's no relief pressure otherwise than the fact that there's buyers and sellers. And there's no manipulation of that quantity nor price in which you can smooth it. So that's the most important thing. Are there rails for institutional adoption? And I think the two big story here is one, stablecoin adoption is happening, and stablecoins, I think, is mostly used today to participate in the crypto economy, for where Bitcoin is the pristine collateral for there to be additional leverage that can be built in the system. And then two, you may have seen the Federal Reserve actually just put out a note where they are allowing banks to custody digital assets and crypto assets. And they've sketched out kind of the safekeeping rules to which they would want this to be permissible. But the punchline here is the banks are coming. The banks are going to offer crypto custody services. And once that Rubicon is crossed, you no longer have to deal with the notion of your investors asking whether crypto is like a safe thing to hold or not. And once you know, like the names you're trusted and involved with are in this space, that's a huge, huge boon. So that will just promote more investors to come in. It'll allow brokerages to actually permit more freely spot Bitcoin trading and all those things. So yeah, now I think it's just a little bit of like the final last mile of getting broad-based infrastructure buy-in for not you and me who have already been in the space, but for those who've been looking with a lot of curiosity, a lot of interest, but maybe with still a tinge of that, like, is this still sketchy? And when you have the Federal Reserve actually saying we have rules, that discounts a lot of those things away.
What if I told you you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Instead, you can borrow against it with Salt Lending. Why give up your hard-earned Bitcoin when you can unlock its value without letting it go? With Salt, you get secure Bitcoin collateralized loans with no credit checks, no prepayment fees, and best of all, no rehypothecation. Salt has had zero customer collateral losses since it launched. Salt was the first platform to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans starting way back in 2016. Today, they offer tailored options for both individuals and businesses. And now introducing Salt Shield, the no liquidation solution. No forced liquidations during the lifetime of your loan when you're enrolled with Salt Shield. This just launched at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, and it is next level peace of mind. For Green Candle listeners only, head to saltlending.com/green-candle for this exclusive offer for your Bitcoin collateralized loan. You can get cash for your Bitcoin today. Salt Lending, secure, trusted, proven. Yeah, so then, all right, so it seems like then all bets are off, right? Once institutional kind of gets those handcuffs off, so to speak. And then, but the narrative around Bitcoin right now, at least it seems in the traditional financial space, is that, you know, because now it's an over $2 trillion asset, it's, you know, the sixth, seventh asset in the world by market cap, depending on the day. You know, it's kind of on that back and forth with Amazon. But that the volatility is going to go down, and that's actually going to be a benefit for the traditional, you know, institutional investors. Now, what you're kind of lining out here seems like there's going to be more money that's coming in, right? It's going to be bringing in more investors. So more money to me would mean, you know, that even though it's a higher market cap, we would still have a lot of that volatility. Now, do you think that, are you kind of on the same wavelength there? Or do you think that, you know, more along the lines of the traditional financial, I guess, viewpoint here, where the volatility is going to go down over the years?
Yeah, I think there's many ways to quantify volatility. Volatility can mean something as simple as standard deviation, close to close daily observations over a rolling window of 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. It could also mean, however, the distribution of fat tail events that can happen more or less than normal, which is a vol construct. So what I'm trying to intimate here is, do you consider an asset that's not moving very much day by day, but then moves 30% one day to be volatile or not volatile, right? The intuition here is that volatility matters for the moment in which it happens, and the distribution of those events are equally important as the severity of those events. And my guess and belief is Bitcoin in general will continue to have fat tail events. It will continue to have high vol events where one day it could go up a lot and one day it could go down a lot, simply because, like I've said before, Bitcoin's price is set by the marginal buyers and sellers. And it's actually not that important what the total market cap of the actual asset is. It's not dissimilar from how oil, for example, remains volatile, right? Like oil could be the biggest commodities market on earth where there's an incredible buyer base and seller base on the product attractive use case of the global economy, and yet oil is very volatile in moments of distress or news events where people have been unexpectedly or unhedged towards these outcomes to geopolitical affairs. So my instinct is Bitcoin will look more like oil in the way that it trades, where there will be high vol events. And because of that, I think the volatility, it could look muted day to day, but it doesn't mean that it's actually like a fixed income asset. If anything, it will still, I think, have lots of peaks to troughs in the ways to give investors a great room of outperformance and underperformance based on active management.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I kind of like I really like the way you put that about, you know, kind of still having those highly volatile events. But it's been kind of interesting in this cycle where I think we're getting the volatile events based more on Bitcoin related news opposed to, you know, maybe geopolitical or macro type of factors. Now, to me, that almost feels like it's going to be kind of short lived, where now soon everybody's going to have this massive waves of adoption where, you know, this company's buying Bitcoin, this company's buying Bitcoin, these new ETFs, this government's buying Bitcoin, what have you. But soon I feel like it's going to be normal place. And then, you know, it's going to be more kind of ingrained into just the overall macro landscape. Do you kind of see that development here right now where it's, you know, hey, maybe Bitwise or, you know, BlackRock or somebody's announcing something and that sees the giant wave up. But then on the flip side of things, like eventually everybody's going to own Bitcoin and it's just going to be more ingrained in just everyday business and life.
I think it's a good question. I think, you know, we who live in crypto every day can also develop a sense of myopic perspectives towards what Bitcoin represents to us. But the reality is, like, when we step out of this bubble, like, there are still a lot of people who don't understand Bitcoin, who really don't. I was just having a conversation with one of my college friends, really, you know, bright person. And, you know, even today, I would say she's fairly dismissive about Bitcoin because there are like fundamental like gaps in understanding of what the social benefits of Bitcoin is, right? Some there are still a world of people out there who consider Bitcoin to be unproductive, wasteful, and actually a wealth creation scheme that has no value proposition to like a productivity creation scheme or a value creation scheme, which you and I would fight back and say, actually, the most valuable thing is having the ability to store your wealth in a way that is censorship resistant. But that in itself can sometimes still fall pretty flat on people who's, you know, wanting to unlock real productivity gains. So I think we're still early in that journey, especially on the institutional front. You know, we're still working at Bitwise to get our ETF approved across a variety of different wirehouses and the bank platforms. And we still have these conversations around this, that very basic fundamental principles and tenets about Bitcoin and the security risks that can exist in the space, because people are still not used to the idea of things you can't hold, right? Like, what do I own? This thing that I cannot touch, you know, it's still a conversation we have. And so you have to assume like there's still a world of investors out there who still haven't wrapped their head around it, that want exposure. And actually, that's why I think these Bitcoin treasury companies at some level are another version of like creating inflows like ETFs, because people actually just know wrappers they like and know, and they're comfortable with it. So people like ETFs because it shows up in their brokerage statement and it says, hey, you own these assets worth this amount and here's a tax cost basis. And they know that because they've seen it before, and it's right next to Facebook stock and Amazon stock. It's still a line of code. Like Bitcoin, it didn't change. It's still this amorphous thing. It just lives now in your brokerage. And that's enough to get like people over the hurdle because they're, oh yeah, I trust the ETF format. I know what a 40 Act fund is, and I know what grantor trusts are, and these things give me comfort. Operating companies are similar. There are people who understand securities. They understand that like value creation can happen through an executive team with operational excellence and financialization of its capital structure, where the job of a CEO is capital allocation. And they understand this approach to investing. So it also then opens up to investors who can buy something like MicroStrategy and get exposure, which is why, I don't know if you've seen lately, but now Vanguard is the largest MicroStrategy shareholder. Vanguard, who hates Bitcoin. Right? So like these wrappers are actually quite important. And the thing that we're really excited about for the second half of this year is there's a wall of money coming from these treasury companies that are going to be price inelastic, indiscriminate buyers of Bitcoin. And as we've touched upon again before, Bitcoin will move based on that marginal demand and price pressure. So, and when it does, it has the chance to move very violently to the up. And I think people have forgotten that it could happen because we haven't seen it in some time. But it can. And the implied volatility market, I think, as of last week, finally started to adjust for that. You know, this whole year, implied volatility has been going down lower and lower and lower, from 60 to 50 to 40 to even below 40. There were times when gold's volatility was higher than Bitcoin's, believe it or not. And then hit its real kind of peak low. And then now we're on the up and up, where implied vol is actually, you know, pricing in the possibility for more movement, which is very exciting because I think that's how Bitcoin's going to win. One worry that I've always had about Bitcoin is it has to be more volatile than gold, because that's actually what young people want. They want volatility. And it's not just the price appreciation they care for. They actually like volatility, leverage, capital efficient ways to make money very quickly.
This bull run, I'm looking for ways to stack Bitcoin in my sleep, and mining has always caught my eye. I've partnered with the guys over at Simple Mining to help you do just that. I don't recommend anything that I don't use personally, so I've got a machine up and running with them right this second. And they've even opened the facility up so anyone can go and visit. They manage over 15,000 machines for 500 clients, handling all of the maintenance and repairs so you don't have to. And for the Green Candle listeners, they're giving an exclusive offer: all the repairs for the first year for free. So if you've been thinking about mining, head on over to simplemining.io/greencandle to get this exclusive offer and learn about the potential tax benefits that you can get from mining with Simple Mining. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show. Yeah, 100%. And I think that's probably the part of the reason why we've seen like such a big gambling uptick as well, is just like, you know, the young people really want to get those boom and bust and that volatility. But you mentioned, you know, Vanguard buying MSTR, being the largest shareholder, and JP Morgan, you know, Jamie Dimon is a huge anti-Bitcoin. You know, it's saying every week it seems like he's saying something new about, you know, how Bitcoin's terrible. And JP Morgan just rapidly increased their shares of MSTR in Q1. And you know, for those of you guys who come to the show a lot, know I love to show that chart of just how big that you know, exponential growth of JP Morgan's holdings of MSTR is. But you said something big about the violent swings up. The narrative right now is, you know, there's a lot of Bitcoin getting taken off exchanges. There's about a little over 2 million Bitcoin left on exchanges. The OTC desks are running out. Do you think that there's, you know, that potential of like a supply shock that we have here? Because, you know, I think that the biggest selling point for me, at least initially with Bitcoin, was the digital scarcity aspect. And I think that that's still a big gap for a lot of people. You know, even though they see that ticker on the screen that they could buy, you know, right next to their Apple stock or whatnot, I think, you know, the underlying asset is something that's so unique that, you know, people are just going to try to keep buying those ETFs or buying, you know, these holding companies. And they're going to realize very quickly, like, hey, you know what, these ET, like, I, this is the first time I wasn't able to buy more of an ETF. Or, you know, there's that potential of that supply shock. Do you see that potentially happening this cycle with the amount of buying pressure that's going on?
I do. I do. And there's one like fundamental misconception, I think, in the Bitcoin community about what these financialized Bitcoin exposure means, the synthetic paper, as people call it, to be diluting Bitcoin, kind of price action or ownership. And most of the violent upswings actually happen because there's a liquidity gap in which there are folks who are short, and they need to cover. And from that perspective, even though these short exposure types of things can feel like it's paper money, It is one of the contributing factors to price movement in a way where price inelastic buying and selling behaviors are introduced. So, I think it's ultimately a positive thing that we get a diverse market for Bitcoin's price action, where you get the chance to have both buyers and short sellers in the mix, because ultimately those are volatility fueling agents. It's also why MicroStrategy has had a lot of volatility beyond the fact that it is, of course, buying Bitcoin on its balance sheet. There are financial arbitrageurs who are out there, and they play different games of shorting, trading gamma against it. These options can also create different kinds of pin risks, and all this financialization like adds some path dependency to the price action in a way that, if it's concerted in the right fashion, are really, really good for Bitcoin. So I think one of the things I'm really excited for is to see some of these things play out, where the supply squeeze, as you've mentioned, the supply shock, combined with some of the offside positioning that could exist within the financial community, leveraging derivatives in Bitcoin, can all come to a point where the buying pressure is pretty immense. So, for example, these Bitcoin treasury companies that are coming online right now, a lot of these are through pipes that have not been registered yet, which means you actually can't actively trade those. But if you thought you wanted to hedge some of those risks right now in the way that you're long these instruments, you might go out there and you might short Bitcoin, or you might short MicroStrategy, right? Because you're doing a pair trade. But imagine if the supply shock that you mentioned is the lead up to Bitcoin's price action, for which now the short is getting squeezed and you actually have to cover it. That has this double kind of amplifying effect on these violent upswings that can be ultimately what sets the price higher. And this is the most important thing, Brandon. I've always described Bitcoin as a flow asset and not a state asset. And what I mean by that is the market cap of Bitcoin is actually irrelevant, because it's not like a stock where like a market cap is justified on its operating cash flow and a multiple of that as a valuation metric to justify whether the present value of that is worth or not worth paying for that today. Bitcoin's not anything like that. Actually, Bitcoin is just a thing that people buy and sell at some price. And the only thing that matters to people are their cost basis. So if they're really in the money, they made money. And if they didn't, they didn't. So if Bitcoin goes from 100K to 500K, right? Let's say it just gaps to 500K. And like there's a bunch of people that lost money, and there's a bunch of people that made money, and eventually they all netted out. The price is just there. It's 500K. Like, it actually doesn't need to come back down. That is the new price in which people are transacting and people are coming in and coming out. And that's what I mean by when I say it's a flow asset. It's just a medium of exchange for a time in which people come in and come out. They might buy Bitcoin to store value, and they might sell it one day to get dollars back. But that thing is reflective of value at a certain time. And it doesn't mean that there's any sense of that market cap in itself being an anchor to like what the spot asset should be worth today, because it's not really like a state asset.
Yeah, and that's very really interesting that you think that. Yeah, I mean the shorts. I mean, it makes all the sense, right? Because I mean, yesterday we are maybe 2 days ago now, we had like 1.3 billion in shorts liquidated in 60 seconds, and instead of Bitcoin just going from 119 to 120, it shot past another couple percentage points because of that. And obviously, the more money that comes in, the more shorts they're going to potentially be, and then that just is going to be amplifying every single day. And then, the more violent swings, it seems like it's all for the extremely bullish news here going forward, and the bullish price action. But I've seen a recent interview with you that you talked about getting to one Bitcoin as the new American dream. The narrative right now is that retail still hasn't shown up yet. I want you to dive into a little bit of that mindset too, that you kind of see shifting here, because outside of the price action, like if we have this giant, swing up, it almost seems like getting to one Bitcoin would almost be unattainable. But do you think that that is one, the new American dream, and that people are still going to be, I guess, kind of shooting for that here going forward?
I absolutely do. I do because, the reason people value home ownership in this country in the model of capitalism we have today is because real estate happens to be one of the most protected asset class in this country. If you're a real estate investor, there are tons of strategic structuring tax advantages to which the asset class is 100% supported by the fabric of America's economic engine. So the store of value that homes represent as a result is very much like a generational mindset. And I think what young people are realizing today is that these home values are actually not that reflective of anything that the home is actually worth. It's probably worth a lot of other things as to, just living a life that you want to live, whether you might have kids you want to send schools to, and these like social things matter. But at the end of the day, that doesn't have to come by ownership, right? That can be a rental model. And actually, if you leave the US, like if you go to Europe, for example, there's a whole norm out there where renting is the thing. You just rent and live. And actually, I didn't even know this until very recently. Apparently, in the London real estate market, none of the homes you actually own are even real deeds. Like all of the land, for the most part, is generally owned elsewhere with like 100-year, 500-year lease type things that ultimately go back to the crown. So like you actually don't even own the land for most of the condos and like homes you'd buy in London, which is crazy because like you actually don't even think about that here in the US. But all to say, like what I think young people have found really worthwhile is that Bitcoin is the thing that is going to store value better than real estate.
So
I think
then,
that's
sorry to cut you off. Well, but basically, I was just going to say, so then everything seems to be tr shifting from that $300 trillion real estate market towards Bitcoin. Is that what you see coming?
I think it's entirely possible that we'll see some of that depression come to real estate as a result. Look, real estate is not free in the sense that it's not just buying the home. There's a lot of servicing costs that gets associated with it on a maintenance basis, right? So first of all, let's take the mortgage out of the question for a second, which is obviously a servicing cost. There's usually like, of course, there's the property tax, right? And that property tax is anchored to the home value, to which the inflation of the home value inflates the tax, which inflates the state's tax on you. And so the whole like race to the bottom of these fiscal and state deficits is if reflected in real estate too. And then you, of course, have like common charges or like whatever community charges you might have in your home ownership, and those things are also administrative, and they do go up with inflation. So all of these things, you're locked in where the cost of carry is actually indexed to inflation and usually more. Bitcoin doesn't have that. I think this is a profound thing. Like Bitcoin, actually, if you just have it, you don't actually have to keep paying more money to just keep the same amount of Bitcoin. It's the other way around. People come in and help you realize the value proposition of Bitcoin's growth in the network. Real estate really is the opposite, where you just have to keep spending money to own it. And you have actually no way to control any of those exogenous variables. If the state says they're going to raise property tax, or if Trump comes out and says the salt tax deduction is changing, all of those things are out of your control, and you're at the whims of ultimately what the federal government wants to exert on its tax basis. So I think this is a broader movement where young people are fed up and they don't want to let others control their destiny in ways where they feel like they're constantly getting shafted by things they cannot control and decide. Bitcoin just gives you such incredible freedom and ownership and peace of mind that you own what you own. It cannot be inflated away. They can't put a tax on it. They're not gonna, like have it in a situation where like you have to liquidate it against your own will. Like it is safely with you. I think there's something really peaceful and beautiful about that that young people have embraced as comforting. And I don't blame them. And I think that's also why Bitcoin is always going to win. Where the general trend of society is this disillusionment with governments and centralized intermediaries that don't seem to have their interests at heart.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty. But simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm gonna help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of the shift that we're seeing, right? I mean, you know, I think River put out a study here recently that detailed that more Americans own Bitcoin than own gold. And that includes the ETFs and all those different, you know, aspects there. And I think we're starting to see that flock over towards Bitcoin as more of that safe haven asset for, you know, multitude of reasons, not only just because of the real estate stuff that you're lining out to, but more as like, you know, the inflationary hedge as well. So do you see that shift as well, that people, maybe the gold bugs are starting to get over, or is that just a narrative that us Bitcoiners like to tell each other that, you know, the gold bugs are finally starting to see the light of Bitcoin?
I think we have some clients at Bitwise who are big investors of both now more than before. So I think there is an awakening of that trend, though I will also say it's pretty bifurcated. I almost don't see any people mid-curving gold and Bitcoin. Like, basically, they're very passionate about either embracing it or antagonizing it as a gold investor. There's no one that's like a gold investor that has like no opinion on Bitcoin, which I think is kind of telling, which ultimately means they understand it's either a competition or a substitution, and both of them, you're either supportive or you're going to be against it. And that's reflective of truly what Bitcoin is. It can be a substitute, but it could also be a complement. And in my case, I love gold just as much as I love Bitcoin too. They're both valuable to me. And at the same time, you know, you might feel like they're actually more differentiated, where you couldn't have that view. Ultimately, I think what it comes down to is the price action. If you think that there's benefit in portfolio diversification, where the correlation between gold and Bitcoin is small enough to warrant the ability to push out the efficient frontier of your modern portfolio by owning both, then that's easy to explain, right? That's just math. And I think that will get a lot of people over the hump. And so far, I think people have shown that actually having both gold and Bitcoin is additive. And we actually launched a product in Europe where we actually have a Bitcoin and gold as a mixed index basket strategy, because it's done well together than actually independently of each other, from a risk-adjusted return, from the ability to earn return on a vol unit basis. So I'm a proponent for most people to consider owning both, and that we shouldn't necessarily antagonize each other's interests, because I think long-term we're actually all pretty much aligned. Gold bugs and Bitcoin investors have so much more in common philosophically than they might even know.
I mean, I agree. Like, I mean, Peter Schiff to me is like a perfect example. Like, I agree with like 99% of the things that he's saying with, you know, the overall macro economy. It's just his view on Bitcoin. He just, for some reason, just won't agree and won't come over, even though he was at the Bitcoin conference and spoke there this year, which I thought was crazy. But I think it's just a sign of the times that eventually they'll all bend the knee, and maybe he just realizes at this point it's his brand to be against Bitcoin, but who knows? But I definitely think that that's kind of going to be a growing trend. But we've talked about the ETFs a little bit. You guys just made a big announcement here recently about your ETF product, actually this morning as we're recording it. So why don't you detail a little bit about that announcement, and we can discuss a little further about what the implications are, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So When we launched the Bitcoin ETF, one of the things that we were really proud of was we launched it in the ways that crypto investors would find alignment for all the virtues of the blockchain technologies for which Bitcoin can empower transparency, and DYOR, and all the proof of attestations to the ways in which people really want this idea of trust, but also verify. We had our custodial wallet addresses that were shared. So any of us can click and go on Block Explorer and check that we actually do own the Bitcoin that we said we do in the Bitcoin ETF. And I think this was really popular and well received by the community. Today we made the announcement that we're going to actually do something a little bit different, which is we are partnering with a firm called The Network Firm, and they're actually a CPA accounting firm. And they are bringing to us what is really a proof of reserves report that brings several benefits. One is we now have the ability to verify both sides of the ledger, not just the assets, but also the liabilities from the ability that they can navigate as an accountant. And then they also therefore give us an independent examination as verified by such a third party while still leveraging all the public keys that we have historically shared in the past. So I think in a way, this is like one step up to how people have attacked the proof of reserve construct by sharing that it's not enough if you don't have the liabilities also existing side by side to see the net effect. So this is one dimension of going forward on that. But the other part is really that we were having a lot of conversations with institutional firms who still had some worries about these public key addresses posing different kinds of risks in the future that might be unanticipatable. And this was a way to show, well, we can address you, we can address all of these things together at once and the benefit that everybody can feel better off. The reality is my view, and broadly, I think most crypto investors' view would say that sharing your public keys actually doesn't introduce like an actual technical risk from a security perspective, but maybe it does introduce some kind of diminution of your privacy, for example. And maybe there's something to be said about privacy that institutional investors have a different standard for, and actually would find that to create different kinds of OPSEC risks that they think is still unwarranted. We think that the ETF is actually one of the most transparent, predictable, and automated things that could never exist. Literally, we just buy Bitcoin based on client demand, and that's it. It's a passive vehicle. So there is no real like OPSEC risks that could arise out of it. But at the same time, it's important that we try to be institutional in the ways that can bridge the gap between crypto and the mainstream investors. And I think this is one step ahead in that direction where everyone's going to be able to win off of now having some additional proof of reserve constructs with its liabilities.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You could go to the bitcoinwell.com /greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens. You flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks. 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000, and they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada. And on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin, and that's self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today. Enough for me, back to the show. Yeah, so I mean, I do agree that it is really unique that everybody in the Bitcoin space is very much about privacy, but then they want, you know, the ETFs to show these proof of reserves. So, and it seems like it's been kind of like a hot button topic, right? Like some companies have now published it. Some ETFs have published, you know, their wallets. You guys obviously were a leader and a forefront at that at the beginning. But you know, from your perspective, do you think that it's going to be more of a, I guess, a norm to potentially, I guess, go towards, like, are you guys viewing this as somewhat of setting the standard where, you know, it is kind of like an institutional worry for you to publish your Bitcoin addresses just because of, you know, the way that traditional finance has gone about it. And this can kind of help weather some of those worries, at least initially, and that we'll get to a point where maybe everybody's publishing their addresses down the line. Or do you see it kind of, I guess, staying in the realm of traditional finance here for some time?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think the journey to crypto is never always like foreseeable in the community's reactions and involvement to what they want to strongly hold to their belief system. At the core, there is a fundamental tension between crypto and institutional investors, right? The fundamental tension is that crypto really believes in provenance for which that they are the non-custodial owners. And institutions are built off of a totally different structural mechanism, which is you actually have third-party experts that are able to do the hard work to ensure compliance of the assets and its functions and its strategies that relies upon that expert servicing. And so at times it is a fundamental chasm, but I think this is a really neat way for us to bridge it because we're still leveraging what is really powerful within what is possible within proof of reserve, with also a company that is able to be both a CPA and also a crypto native to bring this accounting package in an authentic way to institutional investors. And I think that's kind of the unlock here. At the end of the day, the other thing that I don't ever dismiss is that most humans are actually really, really bad at having no insurance and having every responsibility fall on you, right? That's why you still hear about people who lose their coins and whatever, and they can't get it back. And they wish they had someone else they could rely on who could help them recover their keys or unwind a transaction or all that stuff. And the reality is, the whole ethos of crypto is it's immutable and irreversible. But that's a very scary, scary thing for most humans. Most humans do not want that level of responsibility at all. It's why people choose credit cards as a way to spend their money than debit cards, because they like having the idea that they can appeal and repeal. So just recognizing that is important. And I believe that truly most Bitcoin investors who love Bitcoin are already going to own it. Pretty much in the way they want. And we're trying to just broaden access. Our number one goal here truly is, can we find more ways to broaden access points for more investors to discover Bitcoin? And hopefully that just leads them down the journey further and further to this self-individualized sovereign model that I think ultimately crypto supports, but is still one that institutions will abide by in the format they know and trust.
Yeah, I definitely agree, right? I mean, I think that the people that are, you know, utilizing these ETF products, that's what they're comfortable with, right? So, you know, I think that there's a way and broadening it for and allowing access to, you know, thousands, millions of people to, you know, to get more access to Bitcoin is definitely the way. And eventually everybody will kind of find out what's the best way for them to hold Bitcoin, whether it's, you know, self-custody, which obviously, you know, huge proponent of here. But, you know, I think that this initial exposure and whether it's through, you know, a brokerage account or something else is definitely the way to go. But Jeff, you've been very generous with your time. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Why don't you tell people more of where they can find out about you and find out about Bitwise and all the stuff that you guys have going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me again, Brandon. I'm generally on X. My handle is DGT10011. I also have a Substack that's viewable on my profile link. Otherwise, you can find me with the Bitwise crew. We're generally around the country, different conferences, different points. I'm here in New York. Feel free to say hi if you're in town. And otherwise, we'll all see each other online.
Amen to that. Jeff, thanks so much for everything you do. And I'll put all that in the show notes. So thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them, and I'll see you guys all at the next one.